Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And the big insight that I've gotten having done over 1,000 interviews is this. If you find a customer who has a really big pain, you don't even have to solve it. You don't even have to get it right. You just have to address it and they will work with you to get it right because the pain is so bad that they need relief. I'm spitting up as I say this because I'm kind of fiery about this, Brandon. It's a good thing we're not in person. And that is basically what Brandon Bruce, the guest that I'm about to interview, has discovered himself. He realized that for salespeople who live in email, making the trip over to, this sounds so silly, but it is a trip from one software that you live in to another, which is Salesforce, to record what you just did in the software that you're already in. It's a bit of a chore and people forget to do it. Stuff comes up. I get it. And it was such a pain that he said, you know what, I'm going to solve it. I'm actually going to create software that makes it easier for salespeople to log their information, to keep their Salesforce updated without having to leave the software that they're in already, which is email. And it was such a strong pain, such a good solution that before he was even up, back when he just had a simple WordPress website, didn't mean to index it, people started signing up and buying from him. And to me, that's an example of how important it is to look for a deep customer pain and address it. So as I said, today's guest is Brandon Bruce. He is the founder of Cirrus Insight. They allow you to sync your calendar and email with Salesforce. He's also the new author of a new book called The Slow Sale, How Slowing Down Can Help You Win More Deals. This interview is sponsored by two companies. The first is HostGator, which allows you and me, and Brandon even used it, to host our websites. And the second one is the company that will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal. I'll tell you more about them later. Brandon, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hey.
Excited to be here.
I got to ask you about one of the past businesses that you had before as a kid. A lot of us have sold candy. You sold what?
Well, my brother and I thought maybe we could sell rocks. And we kind of tried to pass it off as candy, which I highly don't recommend. But we had some rocks and we had some mud. And so we figured, really, you know, if you let it harden a little bit, it looks a lot like See's candies. And so we went out and tried to sell those with mixed results, right? Some people could tell these are clearly rocks. Others, though, were willing to take a risk and make a buy until they realized it was a rock. Suffice it to say, there were a lot of refunds in that business. But, you know, it was an afternoon of fun for two little
kids. I feel
like
this is an indication of an entrepreneurial bent that just had to come out somehow. Am I right? Are you a salesperson an entrepreneur at heart? Or am I just reading too much into this?
No, clearly it should have been real candy, right? That way we would have had actual money.
Right, no doubt.
The fossiling, and that would have hooked us. But we were just on the playground, so we're like, well, let's just go try and see if we can sell rocks. For my kids, and I actually published an article about this recently, when my son and my daughter, who are 5 and 7, went out and sold lemonade and grape juice on the street, and it was great. I mean, my son woke up in the morning and just said, Dad, can you help me carry this table and two chairs? And I said, I can. Where are we going with them? He said, I want you to take them out to the curb. I'm going to set up a juice stand today. And that just came out of the blue. First thing he said when he woke up, no idea where the idea came from. So I said, sure, I'll help you set it up. I said, how much are you going to charge for the lemonade? Expecting him maybe to say, you know, 25, 50 cents. He said, I'm going to charge $1. And I said, well, what do you think about like a quarter or something? And he said, and again, he's 5. I don't know where this stuff comes from. But he goes, Dad, I know you're trying to be helpful. And I know that's your idea, but this is my idea. So I get to do what I want. And I said, that's true. It is your idea. You do whatever you want. And of course, he was right. For one, he didn't have to make change, which would have been hard. And for another, he's 5 and he's a pretty cute kid. So people were all too willing to say, sure, here's $1 for a cup of lemonade. But it is, way back when Warren Buffett said, one of the key indicators of entrepreneurism is how early you start your first business, whether it's selling candy or lemonade or whatever. It's like, how early do you have that urge to get out in front of people and say, hey, I have something that might be valuable. Obviously, lemonade is better than rocks.
I read that article. He made money from it. How much money did he make, including tips?
He did, he did it the one day and liked it so much he did it the next day. And it turns out the reason he had the idea was my wife had told him, hey, you're starting kindergarten next year, so we need to raise some money for your supplies, right? Your books and pencils and stuff. So he's like, well, I better go do that. So he woke up the next morning and wanted to do it. But yeah, he cleared like $38. And so then the next morning, it gave me an opportunity to talk about, well, so you made $38, but we did actually comp you the cost of the length of the heights of the table and the chairs and the space to put it. Right? So that's our contribution.
Speaking of dollars and cents, Sirius Insight, what's the annual revenue from this business?
So right now we do a little over $1 million a month.
$1 million a month.
In MRR. So last year, yeah, we finished right around 10 million.
So talk to me about where you realized this problem. What were you doing in Salesforce? What were you doing in email that made you say, hey, there's got to be a better solution?
It was one of those really obvious pain points once you stop and think about it. But what we had learned is, and Ryan Huff and I, my co-founder, is that we were in Gmail because we were early users of Gmail, right? Back when you had to get an invite from a friend of a friend to get a Gmail account. So we're in Gmail all the time and our customers were in Salesforce. And so every time we got an email, we'd leave Gmail and go to Salesforce and look up the customer, right? Find out how long ago did they buy, how long they've been a customer, they're a big customer, small customer. And after a while, we figured out, man, we're doing that like 200-300 times a day, right? Mm-hmm. So we sit, keep a little log. It's like, that's not good. That's a huge use of time. So credit to Ryan. He started building the app. He's the architect of the app. And really, the conceit, like you described, is very simple. We just said, instead of leaving your home screen for sales, which we didn't want to build a new home screen, we thought, look, email is where we all work. And we've learned that over the last 6 years. Walk around any sales floor, and you're going to see people either in their email inbox, which is Outlook or Gmail, or in their calendar. Those two places. They're rarely in a third place.
And this was a Chrome plugin at first?
Yeah, this was a Chrome plugin. So we had been inspired by other plugins. Really, the first one that was the big inspiration was Reportive, which showed you a LinkedIn profile inside Gmail. And we thought, that is so awesome. And of course, LinkedIn ended up buying it. And we thought, okay, but our customer information, like prospects are in LinkedIn, but our customer data is in Salesforce. So why don't we do what Reportive is doing for LinkedIn? We'll do it for Salesforce.
What were you selling at the time that you needed to keep going back and forth?
So at the time, I was actually, you know, frontline sales for a university. So I was in fundraising. And so I was in the inbox all the time, sending out messages to alumni and to other donors. But then I'd have to go log the information into the database. And I thought, yeah, this is taking a lot of time to do manual data entry. And it's a lot more fun to talk with people and sell than it is to type in results of the call.
Of course, we do research on our guests, which is how I knew about the $38 that your son made from the article in, what was it, in Knoxville News. Yeah. But we also have a pre-interview process. And our researcher who talked to you said that while your partner, while Ryan was out coding, you started talking to businesses and potential partners. Can you talk about some of the stuff that you were doing while he was working?
Yeah, it's kind of it was a great partnership because Ryan was heads down, you know, building this application, which took a tremendous amount of effort. And so I thought, well, what can I do to make sure we get the right product out to market when the time is right? So I basically spent the whole time on the phone. So I had a full-time job at the time, but while I was driving, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours at a time, I would just put together my call list and I would call anybody that I thought was in sales or partners that work with sales teams and just say, hey, we're going to build this product. Are you interested? It's going to connect Gmail with Salesforce. Do you use Salesforce? How do you use it? How many times do you switch back?
What did you learn?
So what I learned from them is there was, in fact, a gap. And that was the number one thing. Because we had read about a gap in various message boards online, like Salesforce Success Forms, Quora, and people were saying, man, this is becoming a pain. But we needed to verify that. You know, because if 5 people say it, it's one thing. If 1,000 people say it, it's another. So on every call, I said, look, if we could make it so you didn't have to switch back and forth, and if we made it so that you could save your email correspondence into Salesforce in one click, would that be valuable to you? And thankfully, the unanimous feedback was like, okay, I get it. Yeah. Like,
was it just validation, or did they help shape the product or turn you on to something you didn't realize before? Like maybe they weren't using Chrome as often as you thought. What did you learn that you didn't know?
It's a good question. It was a combination of both. The initial value was validation. Like we knew we wanted to show you who the person was in Salesforce, and we knew we wanted to allow you to put basic information into Salesforce. What came next, though, is as soon as they said, yeah, that'd be valuable, then, of course, they've got a product person on the phone, so they're going to say, you know what would also be cool is if I could update opportunities without leaving Gmail, or if I could set a follow-up reminder task, or if I could set an email to go out in 3 days, because I know that it's not right for follow-up now, but it will be 3 days from now.
I see.
And so that became the roadmap. And so then our big decision was back in 2011, do we launch next week or do we launch in 4 months? Because we had like a 4-month roadmap of features that we thought were going to be pretty awesome. So we're like, yeah, that'd be pretty neat if we could launch with a fully baked product. But thankfully, and I still think this was the best decision we made in the company to date, we decided to launch right away. And that made a lot of difference because we were able to be the first app to market that connected Gmail and Salesforce.
With nothing but, which is not that simple, but nothing but I'm in my Gmail, and it was Gmail only as I understand it at first.
Yep, it was.
I look to the right of my screen, and in that margin, which is kind of empty in Gmail, or I guess it has ads if you don't have ad blocker, which I do, right in that right side is information about the contact that you're talking to from your own record that you saved in Salesforce.
Exactly. Now, that was the original value proposition was twofold, and that was one of them. And the other one was, now that I'm emailing with this customer or prospect, I want to save that correspondence into Salesforce so that I have a record of it in the future.
Oh, I see. So it was also the ability to take someone who you're following, who you're messaging, and add them to Salesforce.
Yeah, those were the two killer features. And there were a few other features in there, but those were the two that really sold people.
And you know what? And I was laughing as I said it because it seems simple. It's on the same computer, the same keyboard, the same mouse. Right. But you know what? It takes you out of the momentum. It stops your momentum and shifts you in a different direction. I completely understand the frustration. I completely understand the value. You also were talking to people and trying to sign them up for beta tests, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We had about 1,000 people sign up on, you know, the most embarrassingly simple one-page website that I could hack together.
Same URL as you have right now, Sirius Insight.
Yeah. SiriusInsight.com, and they would just put, you know, are you interested in trying out our connector for Gmail and Salesforce? Put in your email address.
How'd you get 1,000 of those?
Well, Ryan did a good job, but he carpet-bagged Dreamforce. So the big Salesforce conference in San Francisco, and he went there in the fall of 2011 with little postcards and just said, hey, do you use Gmail? Hey, you should check out our app. And so between that and then I did a lot of direct outreach. Everyone I talked with on the phone, thousands of phone calls, and then a lot of just direct on LinkedIn and on message boards. Just, hey, you guys are complaining about this pain point. We've got something and we, you know, it's not ready to sell, but we'd love to get your feedback and you tell us if it's what you wanted. And so those folks jumped in and it was their feedback that really encouraged us to get out to market. They said, well, it's valuable enough. We think we'd be willing to pay for it.
I see the first version of the website. This was, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like this is a WordPress site with a standard theme with some customization on it, right?
Yeah, probably. And probably the one you're looking at, maybe the first one after launch. The one pre-launch was one page and it had little twinkly stars in the background.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And that was you who put it up. Sorry?
What's that?
So that was you building it also. And you said to our producer, hey, look, there was a mistake that I made as we were trying to build the site. I accidentally, and you know how in WordPress, guys, if you're listening, there's that setting that when you first set up your site, it says, do you also want it indexed? And usually you'd say, no, I don't want it indexed. I want to play with it a little bit. And then later, well, that's what you change, right? Brandon?
Yeah,
you
didn't know that setting existed. Okay. So I was thinking, well, this is a secret until I tell Google, but Google found it. They're good at that. And so it got indexed and people started finding the new site pre-launch. And one of our beta users arrived at the site and put an order through. And this was great news for lots of obvious reasons and some non-obvious ones. Originally, it was great news just because we figured out that the order system worked, which was a surprise because we hadn't tested it really internally. But Ryan did a great job building it. So when an order came through, then it would hit Stripe that we use for payment processing, hit the bank account, and then we get a text message that would say, at the time, $5 user a month. So $60 hit your bank account. So I got a text message like, holy cow, someone put an order in. Yeah. It's not one of us. So it was like something worked. And so I called them and I said, hey, you know, you're a beta user. We're going to give you that for several more months just because you've been nice with your feedback. And he said, well, don't worry about it. After those months, I'm going to sign up anyway. So I'll just be your first customer. So that was like any good barbershop, right? That was our first dollar up on the wall from someone that said, this was valuable enough software to buy. Because all of us use great software every day that's free. And so that was important validation for us that we could possibly build a company around it.
You know what? I like the first version of your site, which I'm looking at right now. It even included like a Google Voice call me button, which were all the rage back then. What I can't figure out even looking at this page is what's free? What's the difference between what's free and in the premium package? I don't think that sales page made it clear at all. It seems like the free package includes instant Salesforce lookup in email, immediately see contact info for your contacts. What was the difference? What were you charging?
I think on the paid version, if I remember, back 5 years ago, it had more to do with the ability to save incoming and outgoing emails into Salesforce. So it's like, if you wanted it to be, in a sense, read only, then at the time we provided it for free just to get you involved. And then as soon as you want to start adding a lot of data into Salesforce, that was essentially the paywall.
How did you know that? How did you know that's where you should be charging? Did your calls influence it? Was it something else?
Yes. I mean, as with most pricing decisions, we were not terribly scientific about it. We kind of looked around the market and looked for apps that we thought had similar utility, apps that we were using, and we kind of looked at their pricing and we said, okay, we're new, so we're not going to be at the top end of the market, but we also feel like we have more value than stuff that's out there that's free. And we were unique, so we didn't really have a comp to say, well, we're going to get in the market against so-and-so. We were the first in. So we thought, okay, we're going to price it at $9 user a month. But for our initial users, for the first, I think we said, the first 500 people to sign up, we said they'd get it for $5 user a month, right? Paid annually.
First 500 users get it for $60 a year per user for life.
Yeah, and some of our customers still have that. Now, many of them have upgraded the plans that we've released subsequently, but we still have customers that pay that, which is a great deal.
I imagined as I was looking at it that you guys said to yourselves, you know what? If we can get to $30,000, then it gives us some comfort and allows us to do something. And I just don't know what that something is, but it seems like that was there was a reason behind that, that you wanted that money for something.
Yeah, a lot of it had to do with that we borrowed some money to get some development help on the areas that we weren't as strong in, so for the app itself. And so that was a $50,000 loan, which we were able to pay off 4 months after starting the company, which is a great feeling because then it's like, okay, we're free and clear. We don't owe anybody anything. They helped us get the company off the ground. They're paid off, so they're happy, and we took risk off the table. And now from then on, it was just, let's see how fast we can go and can we get it big enough to like leave our jobs and do it full time.
All right. I'm curious about your funding. I'm curious about how you got customers beyond that initial set of conversations. But let me take a moment here to talk about my sponsor, which is a company called HostGator. And before the interview started, I asked you the same question I ask every guest, which is, can I talk about HostGator or are you investing in a competitor, which often happens, or maybe there's some issue where there's a partnership with a competitor and I never want to step on your toes. You said, actually, no issue. I've used them. What did you use them for? What did you build on a HostGator?
I think I put up one of the original versions just of my own personal website up on HostGator. And I also put up a website that was designed for like for young people to gather and essentially meet new friends, right? So, I mean, we're talking about this goes back, right? Uh-huh. So I built my first website, I just hand-coded it back in 95. So right after Netscape went public, then we put a website out because we thought it'd be fun with friends in high school. But then later on HostGator, I put up more professional sites because they had that control panel, which they probably still do now, but it's probably got a lot more bells and whistles.
Yeah, now it's super easy. It's one-click WordPress install. Lots of other software can be hosted on it. One-click WordPress install, and then you're in WordPress, and you run your site using simple software. Was of all the sites that you launched before, and I want to come back to the HostGator ad, but what was the one that you thought was most promising? I kind of picture you with a HostGator account saying, I'm going to try this idea, and this is going to be the best. And then actually, let me adjust. What was the one that seemed most promising?
I mean, I think a lot of us early on were intrigued at the ability just to connect with other people on the internet, right? So we had done bulletin boards, and then email came around, and then you could do chat, like on AOL, right, when you signed in, and then you could start chatting with people all over the world, and that was pretty cool. So I was like, oh, what about a website where we can all meet each other? And then I had had this great experience in high school where I applied to this essay contest and won, and they flew a bunch of us out to Japan to talk about the future of the internet, and I thought, this is the best thing ever. And so when I came back to build essentially our first website, some friends in high school and I built a website that was in like five or six languages. So in that respect, it was pretty unique. So we put it up in English and Japanese and German and French and Spanish with the idea that folks from any of these countries could come and log in, but then we would essentially translate for them. That didn't become a business or even a thriving project, as it were, but it was a great experience for me building a site. And looking back, I mean, we learned a lot. You know, when you go to publish your first page in Japanese and it comes up, it's the encoding's different. And so it comes up looking like gibberish because we hadn't encoded it properly. So we learned a lot about how the internet works.
Yeah, I've seen that. Well, anyone out there who's looking for a new hosting package because you don't like your hosting company, I really urge you to try HostGator. There's a reason why so many people who I've interviewed have used HostGator at one time or another. It's easy to set up, it's reliable, and it's the company today that will really scale with you. So, for example, you can start out with what they call the Hatchling plan, which is a $3.48 a month plan. But if you want to keep growing and have dedicated server, manage WordPress hosting, whatever it is, they will grow and they have those options that that you can use. I feel like there are tons of opportunities, by the way, Brandon, for businesses like the one that you kind of described, which is these matchmaking services. Yep. Build a website that matchmakes people. Like, imagine one for translators or one for running coaches or whatever. You do it as a matchmaking service, then you grow it into a marketplace, and then it stands up on its own as a business. So whether you guys are listening to me and you want to do something like that, or you have another business idea, or you already have a site up and running and you're looking for a really good hosting company, go check out the one that I just put my new site, my new business on. Go to HostGator. Check them out at this special URL where they'll not only give you 50% their already low prices, but you'll also be tagged as a Mixergy customer, which means if you have any successes, I'd love to talk about you the way I have about other entrepreneurs here on Mixergy. And if you have any challenges, I'd love to help step in too. So here's the URL. Get that discount. Get that promo code. It is HostGator.com/Mixergy. HostGator.com/Mixergy. And I'm grateful to them for sponsoring and giving 50% off to our audience. Funding. You guys were just a couple of guys. You borrowed money. Who'd you borrow money from?
This was originally from Ryan's family. So we borrowed some money early on. This is the classic, you know, friends and family. Who's going to support you the most, right? Yeah. Who believes in you? Who thinks your idea is good? But more importantly, thinks that you'll work hard and you'll pull it off regardless of what
who
the
was
idea.
It in his family who believed in him that much and had the money?
Yeah, on his folks.
It was his parents. Okay. Yeah, so they put in $50,000.
Yeah.
And within a year, you guys were able to pay them back.
Yeah, we paid him back 4 months later.
4 months later. That's phenomenal. And I'm looking at the business to get a sense of what you were thinking of doing with it. Yeah, the company name was, or the site was called cirrusinsight.com. But I see here on the bottom, it's CirrusPath, LLC. I get the sense that you had this idea that it might expand beyond this one site.
Yeah, that was exactly right. And Ryan's concept was, we'll call it CirrusPath. The first product will be Cirrus Insight. Thankfully for us, Cirrus Insight has been very popular. So that's given us all we can eat.
What are you going to do? Create more plugins?
Yeah, or just more applications. You know, Ryan's got a lot of expertise. He's one of the best in the world at building Salesforce apps. So he knows the platform really, really well. And he built a lot of the other apps that you see on the AppExchange for other companies before we started Cirrus Insight. So I think the thinking was, we can build all sorts of stuff that will be useful for folks. But we also didn't know what would be appealing and what would work necessarily. I mean, you never really know until they get out to market. So thankfully, you know, folks started buying Cirrus Insight, and we saw a path toward growing it. So we said, well, let's focus on that. And we've tried to do that with at least one other product, but we quickly returned back to focus on Cirrus Insight.
What was the other product?
So we acquired an application that had a connection between Google Drive and Salesforce. And we thought, well, this is great. You know, we have Gmail with Salesforce, and then we added Outlook and Android and iOS. We connect any inbox in the world, really, with Salesforce. And then we thought, yeah, well, now let's tackle the problem of, you've got files in a repository like Drive, but you want to associate them with contacts. You know, you want to associate a contract or a proposal with a contact. And so the app was really slick, and we used it a lot internally, and we had some great customers for it. But at the end of the day, Cirrus Insight was growing a lot faster. So in terms of where we spend our time and resources and dedicate the roadmap, you know, as a small company, we had to make the choice to focus. So we doubled down on the Cirrus Insight side.
When you were talking to people before you launched, were you doing anything to make sure that they were all similar? I mean, obviously that you wanted everyone to be using Salesforce, but was there any other screening process that you went through to make sure you were getting a consistent group of people?
A lot of the outreach we did that I did was to partners. And so there's a directory of, you know, folks that had gotten certified with Salesforce as partners. And so I talked with them.
These are the people who help implement Salesforce at other organizations.
These are people, yeah, that help companies get on board with Salesforce, that help customize Salesforce once they're on board, or that build apps for folks.
Why did you focus on them, people who build apps and service clients?
Because we knew they knew the platform really well. And by talking with one partner, they could speak to the experience of dozens of their customers.
I see.
So look, across my whole customer base, X percent use Gmail and X percent have this problem, and I've seen it with my own eyes. and I could take this product to them and they would want to use it.
And it's validation that they're using Chrome or Firefox, which you were using at the time, and not suddenly Safari or something else. I see. Yeah. Or the desk. I'm surprised they weren't using the desktop email client.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the vast majority of folks that use Gmail on the web. And then by contrast, almost everybody that uses Exchange or now Office 365, even though there's a web-based option, almost everybody uses Outlook.
Yeah.
And 99.
And you guys now work with that desktop version of Outlook.
Yeah, we work inside Outlook. We work in Office 365. So we've tried to branch out to make sure that we meet any salesperson that's in the inbox where they are.
So, you know, Brandon, one of the things that I noticed is, yeah, it starts with a problem often, and then it goes on to a group of people who are all similar so that their issues are the same and their pain is the same and the solution could be similar for them. The final leg of this three-legged stool seems to be new technology that didn't exist before. So it's not so much that you just discovered a pain that didn't exist before, but there's a new way of solving it or addressing it that hadn't existed before. Is that what happened in your case? And I know it's not 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was pretty new. I mean, it's safe to say that we were not the first browser extension out there, but browser extensions were still pretty young at that point. There's hundreds of thousands of more of them now than there were back in 2011 when we launched. I think what was certainly unique about it was the concept of, because lots of people were even back then, and especially now, starting to build sales software. And a lot of them start with this concept that, hey, we're going to build a place where salespeople can live. And it's going to combine email with phone with the database and all these other things, and we're going to build them a new home. And our philosophy from the beginning has been salespeople already have their home, and it's the inbox, and that's not going to change for a long time, right? People have said, well, you know, Twitter is going to replace email, and then it was supposed to be Facebook was going to replace email, and every new platform is going to replace email. And we always say, yeah, but what do you need to sign up for one of those services? Mm-hmm. You need an email address. It's a fundamental
technology. These days, actually, a phone number might be enough.
Yeah, maybe. But suffice to say, most sales now still happen through email, right? Our interview today happened. Yes. We scheduled it by email and with a calendaring tool, and then it went to the calendar. Did it make it into Salesforce on either of our sides? It did on my side because I automatically synced it with our app, right? And so the app takes care of that part, but the relationship part, I always tell people, and Salesforce is not unique in this respect, but any CRM is really a misnomer. CRMs are not customer relationship management tools. No one's ever forged a relationship in a database. It's a sales management and reporting tool. It's a place to put data and then run a report on it, see how things are going. Customer relationships are built in the inbox, over the phone, through the calendar, and in person. You can also do some correspondence by mail, but not too many people do stuff by regular mail. That can be valuable. But that's where relationships are forged. No one has ever built one through a database and said, you know, tell you what, I'll meet you inside of our Salesforce.
But you know what? Here's what else. I'm actually doing research as we're talking to see if any of the, and just to bring up something and have you tell me if this makes sense. I'm looking at the history of Google Chrome. It wasn't until September 9th, 2009 that Google enabled extensions by default in Chrome developer channel. So not the mainstream Chrome. It wasn't until, I think it was the following year that they finally launched the extension gallery, meaning 2010, this was just before you guys launched, and then they had 1,500 extensions. And it wasn't until the following year, 2011, the year that you guys launched, that they finally had a robust extension ecosystem. And so what I'm getting at is, without extensions in Chrome, this wouldn't have been possible. Without Gmail, this wouldn't have been possible. So you found a pain that a group of people had, and maybe this new way of solving it that wouldn't have been possible 5 years before when people were using just Outlook and Outlook wasn't really extension friendly. Is there any lot? And tell me if you disagree.
No, absolutely. That's the risk and reward of the way that we've built it. So the reward is, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants, right? Gmail and Salesforce are these massive, fast growing platforms. And we thought, well, if a lot of people are going to use both, and this was right at the time where Gmail was starting to become popular in companies. So yeah, there were a 500 million people using it for their personal Gmail accounts, but companies were just starting to get comfortable, like, sure, we could move all our email to the cloud. That would be okay. And companies are still making that move. And so it was a good chance for us to lock in and, you know, join at the hip, if you will, with two companies that were growing really fast as companies said, great, let's go to the cloud. At the same time, and people have written a lot about this, that building on other people's platforms can have some risk. right? So we're built inside Chrome. So if Chrome had decided 2 years later, you know what, we don't like having all these extensions in there, we're going to just build it ourselves, that would have been it, right? I mean, it's their playground. We just built there. Thankfully, we were among enough other extensions that provided value that Google has stuck with it as a framework.
What about this? When people started dropping the desktop as a way of communicating or shifting more of their attention to mobile, you can't put plugins on Chrome for mobile on my iPhone.
Right.
What happened to your business at that point? How did you guys adjust to that?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on mobile, and we're proud of the mobile app we've built, but it's not been easy. So there was a big focus, I'd say, three and a half years ago, everyone said, everything is going to go mobile, 100%, right? And it was like mobile, and this was when the big mobile app acquisitions were happening. So we were like, holy cow, we better get on the bandwagon. And that's when we started our mobile app development. Has everything gone mobile? No, it has not. Is it good to be mobile enabled? Absolutely. But at the time and still now, there are no hooks to get into Apple Mail on your phone, nor is there a good hook to get into, Chrome on your phone running Gmail. And so we had to build from scratch a mail client for your
phone. A brand new mail client.
And
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, just so that we could connect it with Salesforce and also do kind of the email power tools and calendar power tools that we like to do. So when you send an email from your phone, you want to know if the person who received it opened it or not. I do, because if I sent a proposal and they never opened it, the chance of it getting signed is really, really low, like zero. Yeah. If they did open it, then I can call them and say, hey, I'm just calling to follow up on the proposal. I was just looking at your proposal. What a coincidence. Mm-hmm. That's just good follow-up, right? So having that ability now from mobile is great, because it's all, for us, it all runs on the same platform. So while it's a native app for iOS and Android, it runs on the same platform as our Outlook and our Gmail. And that way, you can send a message through Outlook and you get an alert that someone opened it on your mobile phone that night. And that way, you're always plugged in.
You were doing individual sales, and we talked about the first early pricing. And then at some point, you guys started doing these bigger deals. I'm looking here at a list of milestones at the company, and one of them was this $5,000 order. How did you get that?
That was the power of a deadline. So we had said, hey, the special discounting is going to end at midnight on this date. And so if you want that $60 a year discount, you got to get the order in. And so a pretty significant company out in the Midwest saw the app, just learned about it, and said, oh no, the clock is literally ticking. And they put the order in just shy of midnight. And so it surprised me, because I had been doing all the demos up until that point. And so I've never heard of this company before. I've never showed them the app. And it's because they didn't have time to see it. So I mean, they called me just to say, hey, we're going to put an order through. Is the app going to work well for us? And I said, it's working well for these other folks. I think it will. But I didn't know they were a big company. And then they came through and, put in a big order. So when that hit our phone, and we were like, wait a second. If companies are willing to spend thousands of dollars on this, this could get really interesting pretty fast.
Yeah.
So that was exciting.
Is that what led you to think about raising money? Talk about that. Why raise money first? And then we'll talk about what happened when you went out to raise money.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the impetus to raise money was there's a lot of rockiness. It's a roller coaster to do a startup on the emotional side, but also on the financial side. So one day we have a, $5,000 deal come through and we think we've got the answer, right? We've created something of value. Let's go do this every day. And then you don't get orders for 3 days after that. And so like, maybe that was it. Maybe we found the one customer that wants what we're selling. So to help smooth out that cash flow, if you will, there is a benefit to having money in the bank. That way you go to the well when you need to, and when sales are good, then you replenish it. Part of it also, though, was just a competitive environment. So it wasn't long after we launched that other companies started to say, well, wait a second, we're going to compete in one way or another with what Cirrus is doing. So we thought, well, it could be good to have some ammunition if we're going to go into a competitive situation. And so that's when we started talking with, various investors.
And so you found one. And can you talk about the company you told me about before we started? What was the name?
We had talked with a software company in Irvine that was called Quest at the time. And they had said, hey, we're really interested in backing you all. So we were very excited about that possibility. And we kind of came to a verbal on it. And we had built out a big plan. Here's what we're going to do with that money. Here's how we're going to scale and so forth. They then ended up, if it wasn't the next day, it was within 2 days after that, they got acquired. by Dell in Texas, and so that really froze all of the venture in M&A, or certainly it froze our deal. So what we were left with is a plan that we were excited about, but not the money to execute. So we kind of said, well, we'll go back to doing what we were doing, but we still felt pretty strongly that we could execute on the plan. And so at that point, thankfully, some angel investors stepped up and said, hey, send us your plan. This was just in conversation. We said, well, we thought we had a deal, and the deal fell through. It happens. And they said, well, send us the plan, and if we like the plan, we'll just do it on the same terms. So they came in, and we did. And that was great. It provided us with the ability, really, to hire our first employees. Because the cash flow was rocky enough, we just didn't feel comfortable emotionally hiring someone and saying, like, great, so we paid you last month, but then sales weren't as strong, and so we can't pay you this month. We could do that to ourselves, but it felt like it was going to be hard to do that to somebody else.
Do you remember what was in that original plan?
For that plan, it did have to do with very much just basic scaling. You know, we will add salespeople, we'll add a marketing person, we'll add another developer and a support person. We'll be able to invest in some marketing, you know, a lot of the guerrilla marketing that we've been doing, but invest in some actual marketing that required some dollars, like going to an event, traveling, sponsoring things. And then, yeah, trying to hit roadmap deadlines, right? So it's like everything takes time, and we need a little more firepower on the dev side too. So it's kind of all those things rolled up in one.
All right, let me talk about my second sponsor. And the second sponsor kind of connects in with your experience. This business wouldn't have been possible if not for Ryan Huff, right?
Yeah.
You're a fantastic developer. You had an idea, right? You were the guy who experienced the pain. You worked with him. You didn't have to say, Ryan, here's what I want you to do. Line one of the code needs to do this.
He was already off and running because he had the same pain point, right? So he was already developing and called me and said, hey, what do you think about this idea? And then, you know, the two of us had the same pain point.
And he had experience having developed other software for this platform. It's amazing when you find the right developer, that person thinks in a way that 100 different crappy developers couldn't possibly think, which is why so many people in San Francisco, first of all, live here, and second of all, they're constantly racing to do hiring, to find the best of the best developers, because it'll change your business. And that's why so many people hire TopTal. The idea behind TopTal is they have a network of the best developers. When a company needs to hire, they go to TopTal's matcher first. They actually have a conversation with the matcher. The matcher understands the business, understands the software they work with, understands their goals. They have full-time need, project-based need, part-time need, whatever it is. They understand it. Then they go to their network of developers who've all passed tests, who've all gone through their rigorous hiring process. And they say, here's the best one, or the best team of developers. They make that introduction. If it's a match, you can often start within days. We got started within 2 days. Derek Johnson, who I interviewed of Tatango, said he was looking for developers, spent time, he and his CTO, talking to 20 to 30 people. It just became so, so distracting from the main business. They said, let's try this TopTal thing. They interviewed two people from TopTal. They were both good. They picked the one that they felt best about, and they ended up partnering with that person, actually hiring that person, not just part-time, not just full-time, but full-time plus. And Derek's CTO said, this guy is so good, he can be our CTO. That's a level of developers that you get at TopTal. So if you're looking for a great developer, I want you to go not just to toptal.com. And by the way, it's T-O-P-T-A-L. Top as in top of your head, tal as in talent. But not just toptal.com, but the special URL I'm about to give you where Mixergy listeners like you are going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. It is toptal.com/Mixergy, toptal.com/Mixergy. All right, go use them and come back and let me know. I've talked about so many other people who've used them here on Mixergy. If you give me permission after hiring a TopTal developer, I'd love to tell your story, as I've done for Eric Brown, as I've done for Derek Johnson, as I've done for, let's see, there's one other one I just mentioned the other day, Brett Stapper of Hack PR. Lots of people have used them.
And I like how you said, if you're looking for a great developer, for your audience, right? Like, who isn't? Right? Everyone's looking for the best.
What I wanted to screen out are those people who, now that we're not in the TopTal ad, I can just kind of tell you my mentality here, my thinking. I know that Upwork is out there, and I know that there's an audience for Upwork developers. If you're looking for the cheapest developer who you can brag to your friends you're only paying $4 to in some part of the world, this isn't that. This is the, you know what? I need somebody who's going to think differently, who's going to actually help me think through how to solve this problem and come up with ideas that I couldn't tell them. That's who I think, that's who I'm going for.
Yeah, the hunt for the 10Xer.
Right, a 10Xer. All right. Who are the angel investors? I've actually been doing a little bit of prying on your social feeds. I've been looking at your AngelList profile. You guys aren't raising that much money.
It was a range. So it was interesting. So friends and family, but also some of our early customers. And that was just through inbound from them. So we never went to our customers and said, hey, so you know, we were looking for investors. But we had several ride in and say, hey, we really like what you've done with the app. Or, you know, are you guys venture backed? Are you raising money? And we said, well, not actively, but, you know, are you interested? And they said, well, we'd like to be part of the story. Like, we find so much value in it. We think others will too. And we'd like to, you know, participate in the upside if there's going to be one. So we said, great. So some of the angel money is from our customers. And then some was through a group of angels on the coast, right? So in New York and San Francisco.
Is there an angel group that you can mention that did it, that was a part of this? Or
yeah, I think, and I'm trying to remember, I'll get back to that.
I know there was a period there roughly when you guys were raising that these smaller angel groups, were really big. These teams of investors would get together in meetings.
And that group is called, Dot Capital.
Okay.
And so they put together a group of, it's a group of angel investors that pool together.
One of your investors is also a client. Is it hard to say no to them, even though you know that it's not the right fit? What they're asking for is just not a good decision?
Yeah, I think it would have been. We said yes, so I don't know.
You always would say yes. If an angel client asked, you built it.
And there were just a few, right? But it was, hey, these folks are good. Obviously, we're predisposed to like each other because they're saying nice things about our application, that we have a bright future. So we're like, hey, that sounds great. And it was...
I mean, for a feature, you'd build features just because someone was a client and an angel?
No, we haven't. I mean, certainly they've got our ear. So we build features for any of our clients, right? That's probably one of the things that we've done well, and especially Ryan's team has done really well, is listening to the customers. So when they submit ideas at ideas@crsinsight.com, where they tell us as a sales team, we filter it back to development, and we go, okay, great. Do we think other people have the same problem? We'll go ask our customer base, and if they do, then we'll try to build it.
Still, one of the notes that our producer took on your conversation was this little sentence that I'd sum up as saying that staying focused was a challenge for you guys. I don't know how you phrase it exactly, but you did say that was a challenge. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Oh, I think that's symptomatic of a lot of us that classify ourselves as entrepreneurs. We like the next thing, right? The shiny, exciting thing.
So when did you go too far? When did you take on too many shiny new things?
I think we took on too much. You know, things started to heat up with respect to analytics, and now people are calling it artificial intelligence. And I've written about this. So I have an opinion on it. My sense is that it has a lot of promise. There's some cool things you can do with it. Most of the things right now that are being hyped as artificial intelligence just aren't. They're just coding. It's just computer programming. It's not art. You know, I always say artificial intelligence is long on artificial and short on intelligence. Most of the apps, and I've tried a lot of them, don't do particularly well.
Like what? Give me an example of something people were asking for that was artificial intelligence.
So something that we built is a calendaring tool, and it's not AI. It's I want to schedule a meeting with Andrew, and I send you 10 meeting times that are available, and you choose one, and it shows up on my calendar, it shows up on yours. There's other applications that I'm emailing with you, and you say, great, my assistant, some made-up name, will schedule it for you. Well, that assistant is not a real person. That's a bot. And so now I'm communicating with a bot, and your bot is going to try to schedule a meeting with me based on the content of my email. That does not go well. At least,
yeah, you know what? I'm glad you're saying it. Yes. Yeah. So I signed up for this because I wanted to see how it works. And I'm constantly scheduling with people. I signed up for, I'm going to say the name, x.ai is the one that everyone talks about, right? I'm seeing a weird look on your face. Oh, because you don't want to mention it. I'll mention it. Here's my challenge.
And there's a number of them, right? And I think they're great teams, and I think they're building some cool tech.
And in the future, it'll be here. But now it is a pain because my assistant knows if Friday is all open, Andrew probably is going to work outside of the office. So if there's a meeting, I'll schedule it for Thursday or Monday, which is not all open. But x.ai software says Friday's all open. Anytime of Friday, I'll schedule it. Why don't I just tell him to meet him in the middle of the day of Friday, which is just the worst, because then my whole day is interrupted with one call just because the software saw an empty day. And that's where I feel like artificial intelligence is not quite there, but we're all training it.
Yeah.
Not me. I can't.
That's right.
My
we're
AI
participants
membership.
In the process that will bear fruit one day. But yeah, in my experience, like if someone else is using it, for me as a customer, it's not a great experience because I feel like I've been passed off. So, well, I'm not that important, and so you're going to pass me off to a computer to do the scheduling. And then when I ask, I don't know their computer because they have a real name, and then person a question, of course they can't answer the question, they can only schedule. And so now I'm stuck. They don't
it
know
is
the
kind
answer.
Of weird too there.
Yeah.
I'm okay passing people off or being passed off. If it's faster, I'm happy with it, but I get that in certain sales situations that could be an issue. So you started adding the calendaring system and you're starting to say we started
to look at like, hey, could we build stuff that really takes advantage of machine learning and AI? And I think we were drinking too much of the Kool-Aid. It's like, because other people were doing it and because we don't want to get left behind. The sales space moves so fast. We want to deliver the cutting edge to our customers. I think to be fair, we did lose some focus. We spent some time and resources going down the rabbit hole. And then we backed out of that, and we said,
"What did you build when you were taking your eye off the ball?"
So what we were building, and some of it works fine, but it's not bulletproof. Was kind of the ability to predict what conversations are going to turn into opportunities. When are the opportunities going to advance stages in the pipeline? When can we expect those to close based on the performance of that conversation, but also in comparison with other conversations in that company?
Okay.
And then later, the idea would be, well, okay, Mixergy closes deals one way and Sears Insight closes another, but maybe there's enough similarity that you can anonymize and aggregate them and learn how sales close across lots of organizations.
I see, yeah.
That's pretty cool. People
yeah.
are making some progress on that, but we're a ways out from that data being useful because we've tried some of those tools internally and we haven't gotten a lot of value out of them.
So the tech just isn't developed enough to deal with that, but there is a customer. Do you think there's a customer need for that?
Yeah, I mean, if someone could say, like, for example, we've learned just by running just analytics, right? So it's not AI. We just put it in a spreadsheet and we started running numbers. You know, we know an optimal number of meetings. So we can say, if I meet with Andrew once, maybe twice, that's not optimal. If we meet three or four times, we're golden. If we meet eight or nine times, that just means that one of us wanted to make a friend. Like we're not selling anymore. We're meeting for the sake of meeting. We're, hey, let's just meet again next week. This is a customer that just wants to talk. And those are not deals that close well for us. And so we can predict, it's not 100%, but when I talk with our sales team, like how many times have you met with a customer? And sometimes it feels good to say, oh man, I must have met with them 20 times. That's not a deal that's going to close probably. Statistically, you're in bad shape.
I see. And that stuff you can build the technology is there for.
Yeah.
I'm curious about how you continue to talk to customers. Actually, you know what? Before we get to how you continue to talk to customers to understand what they wanted, the other thing that you said to our producer that struck me as something that's helpful for our understanding of how your customer's pain leads to a great product is you said, we made some small mistakes where we didn't ask the customers about their issues. And one of the examples was this analytics thing. And so I'm wondering, when you did get it right by trying to understand how many meetings lead to a sale, did that come from talking to customers and seeing that they had a pain or a need or an issue? Or was that just an observation?
Yeah, some of it was from talking with them, but some of it was people coming back to us and really pushing back. So I think overall, and this I think is interesting for AI just as an industry, those of us who are in sales, or really anybody, what we want value-wise from a computer is for the computer to tell us the facts. Because computers are much faster at defining the facts than we are, right? So It's like 100,000 rows in a spreadsheet. Man, it'll take me all day to look through it. The computer can look through it in a few seconds and tell me core facts about the spreadsheet. What tends not to work as well, and where you need a lot of training to get good at, and what makes salespeople rebel, is when the computer provides an opinion on what was in the spreadsheet. So they might say, hey, 10 of the deals in the spreadsheet look like they might be in this stage. And then the salesperson can do it. If the computer comes back and says, yeah, I found 10 deals and I went ahead and changed the stage for you, that's very bad. That makes people
really?
Very upset. Yeah. And so we got that feedback from folks about, hey, when you build something, do not move my cheese. You know, I know how to do sales. So don't. So you want to not tell a salesperson it's time to follow up by phone. You just want to say, it's been 5 days since you followed up. And then as a salesperson, you can say, yeah, because my customer's on vacation. And so, great, but thanks for telling me the facts. You can't get too mad at the computer about that. Well, the computer says, you should call them now. And you say, well, I just did call them. But I didn't log the data to the database, so the computer doesn't know that I just called them, right? And so that's a data entry issue, but then you end up fighting with the computer. The computer
never
wins. How do you
know that that bothers
them? What's that?
How do you know that that bothers people?
Because they said so. I mean, they said, well, we were trying this other application, and it told us what to do, and the sales team ripped it out. Like, they got tired of hearing the opinion of the computer. So when, you know, when humans and computers argue, there's always a winner, and it's always the human, because we control whether or not the computer plugged in. And so people did not like applications that work that way.
What is it about the slow sale that got you so interested that you decided you were going to write a book about it?
So it was early on. I think it was the first year of doing sales. So I was doing all the sales, and I got really nervous when we decided to take a long weekend, because I had not taken any time away from business at all. And I had three deals that I felt like were strong, and they were pretty big, and I wanted them to close very much and needed them to close. And so I thought, well, if I'm taking a long weekend, I don't like follow up like I usually do, right? It's really hitting, hey, are we ready? Is there anything more I can do, right? I'm Johnny on the spot, at your service. Then I thought, what if they don't close? And I was freaked out by that. And what happened was, by taking some space away from the deals and not following up, which freaked me out, but it's just the way the long weekend played, that when I got back, the customers had come back on their own and said, okay, now we're ready. And I was like, wow, this is great. You know, this worked, and all three of them closed. It wasn't necessarily that all three of them needed to close to learn the lesson, but the fact that that happened, I tried to kind of slow down a little bit and not be 100% obsessive compulsive about every deal, right? That I needed to like will them over the line all the time. And yes, should salespeople hustle? Absolutely. This is not a book about, hey, don't worry about it. You know, let the customer come to you. That's a quick way to put yourself out of business. But what I think it taught me as a salesperson, and then hopefully now as a sales manager, is to follow up with the sales team, but not to hound them. And we also learned that from running some data. So for us, at least, what we see in the opportunity is a flurry of activity early, the customer starting a trial and they have a bunch of questions. Then it goes into a regular cadence, and then there's a flurry of activity toward the end of the trial where they ask questions about pricing and resolve any outstanding issues. And then it goes quiet. And that's the part that freaked me out and still does a little bit, to be honest, when there's no communication anymore. So there's no communication between the salesperson and the customer, and you're wondering, is the deal going to come through or not? Because, by the way, it's pretty important to keep the lights on. And so then I would go to the salesperson, hey, is this deal going to close? Well, why don't you follow up with your customer again? And then 3 hours later, why don't you call them now? Like, let's skip this deal. It's just going to annoy the customer anyway. What we learned from looking at the numbers was we go into like a 7 to 10 day quiet period. And it's getting comfortable with that quiet period. So at the end of that period is when the customer buys, because they've had time to go through procurement, talk with people with the money, sign online, and get the deal done. If they don't sign in that time, then you kick in into overdrive again and say, well, we don't want this to die. I want to get back in touch with them right away. But we had to as a company get comfortable with that quiet time and letting the deal slow down so that it could close instead of forcing it through.
I get it. That would drive me nuts too. We did all this work. We're so close.
We're so close.
And as a hustler, as a person who's proactive, you want to go and do something. Are there questions that you're trying to figure out? Is there an issue you want to talk to the customer and help them resolve? And you're saying, look, at that point, we just have to understand we need to be patient because they're going through their internal process. Let me ask you one other question from the book. What is a minimum viable sale? And I know you guys have written about this on your blog also, but I want to understand it.
Yeah. I mean, I love the concept in the lean startup that talks about the MVP, the minimum viable product. And I think that's great, especially for someone like Ryan who has the talent to build one, right? So he can focus on, okay, what's the minimum viable product with the right features? Coming from the sales side, where I wasn't the one building the product, what I tried to think about is, what's the minimum viable sale? What can I go and sell today, even before I have a product, and get contracts out the door and get them signed back? You know, what do I need to put in that contract as far as assurances, guarantees, delays, et cetera? What can I put in there that has enough value that someone would reasonably sign for it? So when I've talked at conferences filled with these super smart developers, and I'm not really one of them, right? I'm the interloper, the business guy. And so it's like, what can this person teach us? He can't teach us about JavaScript frameworks. What can he share with us? And what I share with them is, you guys are building these killer products on the side. You're unsure how to take them to market. Try to sell it before you build it, right? Do the super uncomfortable part of going and getting in front of customers and selling them on the idea of what you're about to build And if you can do that, you've got that minimum viable sale that will then fund the development of your minimum viable product.
I see.
And it's a nice way to get to market.
I really wish I was a Salesforce customer just so I can use your software. I'm looking at the app in the App Store, frankly, because I thought maybe that's their weak spot and I could see what issues people have and look at the ratings. And now you guys have solid ratings in here. What I like is the email tracking. I want to know like where people are, and not just the individual email tracking that you guys do, and you can show me how many times an individual email was opened by a client, but it's the aggregate data that I think is helpful. I like aggregate data as someone who does sales.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look at our system and say, wait a second, how come the sales rep sent out an email that outperformed everybody else's by 40%? Like, it's a huge delta. And I go, what did you say? What was your subject line that got that many people to open it? Or better yet, after they opened it, to actually reply or to actually click on the call to action? Because you can game a lot of stuff. And this is important. I mean, we talk about vanity metrics, right? I sent an email and I got 50% open rate.
Right.
It's killer. Yeah, it's because I put in the subject line like, you know, emergency with your credit card. Like, that's not a good email, right? That's bad email etiquette, and it's not going to lead to good brand reputation. So beyond getting email opens, like, did the email that you sent advance a sale? Did you get the person to engage in conversation? Did it kick off a process? And so we look at that aggregate data, and now kind of the next step in the evolution is, you know, you send that first email to a customer that's personalized, and then you want to follow up with that. So you set, okay, step two is a phone call with a call script ready to go. And step three, I'm going to connect on LinkedIn and send a nice message. And step four and five, I'm going to send two follow-up emails. But at any time, if I connect with the customer, we're going to stop that sequence so that we can now carry on with the one-to-one conversation. So that's the product that we have out now, which we call flight plans. So it's basically create a cohort of customers, put them on a flight, let it take off, and now we've automated some of the follow-up, which all
I've
of us
have seen services do that.
What's that?
I interviewed an entrepreneur who has a service that does that, and then it kind of plugs into software that only his team uses. And what they do is they send out a sequence of emails, and like you said, as soon as the client responds, the automation stops, and a human being comes in and then deals with the message. I've seen that.
Yeah, there are services that do that. There are a number of pieces of software that do it. We've gotten a lot of requests for it from our customer base. I think, you know, our angle on it is a number of the services and a number of the pieces of software are, here's a new home screen where you can set up sequences of touches with customers. And what we're saying is stay in the inbox and you can do it through Sirius Insight from there.
Yeah.
So right from Gmail or right from Outlook, that person that you just met, drop them into that flight plan. That way you know that you'll always remember to follow up. And so we have customers using it to send personalized automated emails, you know, kind of on a semi-automatic basis. But we also have customers using it just to remember those follow-ups. So they'll set up step one, follow up in 3 days. Step two, connect on LinkedIn.
Just so they get reminders to follow up with the person?
Yeah, it's all defined reminders. So that there's no question about, well, should I call this person again on Thursday? Yes, because that's how our sales playbook works. We know that we should follow up on Thursday.
Well, I'm looking at the Inc. 5000 list. You guys were number 41, in 2006. You've since about doubled your revenue. What's the best part of having built this company that's on such a fast growth path and doing so well?
Well, it's been really exciting, and it's a shot in the arm for the team, right? So when we applied for Inc. 5000 last year, we thought, man, it'd be great to be on the list. And then it surprised all of us that we were number 41. Right. So that was really neat. So number 41 on the list overall, very high ranking in Irvine, California, where Ryan is. And we were number one in Tennessee because I'm based in Knoxville. So the sales marketing operations team is based here in Knoxville. So it's really exciting for us. So we've got, you know, the plaque up next to the ping pong table, which is where everyone gathers. And it's also encouragement. It's like, okay, we've had a good story so far. We serve a lot of customers. They like the application. What can we do next to push the envelope? But push it in a way that makes sense so we don't lose focus, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be the key.
All right. Well, the website, of course, is I'm making sure, like I said, of course, I said it better be right. If I say of course and then I get it wrong, that's bad. It's cirrusinsight.com, cirrusinsight.com. And, of course, the two websites for my sponsors are hostgator.com/Mixergy and toptal.com/Mixergy. And I'm grateful to them for sponsoring and to you, Brandon, for coming here and telling your story.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
Cool. Bye. Bye, everybody.